This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up, a Yale law professor who's on President Obama's task force about policing talks about the series of confrontations between African Americans and police officers, which have led to high-profile deaths around America. What can we do to stop them? But first, state child advocate Sarah Egan released a report last week that combines hard numbers with frightening stories to paint a picture of life for children at Connecticut's Juvenile Training School and its Pueblo Unit for Girls. The report enumerates more than 500 restraints in a year, long periods of seclusion and inadequate suicide prevention, with conditions which, quote, place many youth at risk of physical and emotional harm. Now the state DCF has responded with a plan to reduce seclusion and restraint and more fully staff the units. Today, Where We Live, conversation about what is in this report and what needs to change. Join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Again, our phone number is 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, wnpr.org/where we live. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. We welcome back to our program Sarah Egan, who is the state child advocate in the state of Connecticut. And thank you very much for coming in once again, Sarah. I appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me, John. I'm glad to be here.
So first of all, tell us about the two facilities that were part of this report. Who exactly is at the Juvenile Training School and the Pueblo Unit?
So the Connecticut Juvenile Training School and Pueblo are state-run juvenile correctional facilities for children who have age 12 to 19, who have been adjudicated for a juvenile delinquency offense and committed to the custody of the state because of their delinquency. The facilities are considered to be, at least CJTS has been identified as a maximum security juvenile correctional program. And the purpose of the facilities is to improve public safety through the rehabilitation and treatment of youth confined within.
We have how many children in total at these units?
So over the course of a year, there are probably a little under 300 that are served. At any given time, the utilization of CJTS has vacillated between 80 and 140 over the last year. Pueblo is a small unit, and it has had a pretty low utilization of under six.
So when we're talking about this population, one thing to note is that, yes, indeed, these children have been in some ways adjudicated. They've done something that has run them afoul of the law. That said, you're talking about a population here that has a very high prevalence of mental health issues, abuse and neglect in the home. Maybe you can just talk a bit more about the specific children who are there in these couple hundred kids.
Right. So I think that that's a really important question. So we're talking about, you know, there's a book of poems that was put out in Connecticut several years ago. And I think I thought about that book often when I was doing this investigation. And it was entitled, I Am Not a Juvenile Delinquent. And so when we use that term, which is the technical term for how kids can get committed to the state, I thought about that. What does it mean to be juvenile delinquent and committed to the state? Well, Connecticut is no different than many other states in that, you know, kids who find themselves in the deep end of the juvenile delinquency system are not hardened criminals. First of all, they're young. They are kids who have significant mental health and treatment needs. They have significant trauma histories, which include experiencing violence, witnessing violence, experiencing histories of gross physical abuse or neglect, sexual abuse, particularly for girls. They have unmet learning needs, unmet treatment needs. A not insignificant percentage of kids are also who are at CJTS in Pueblo are also committed to the custody of DCF because of abuse and neglect, meaning the DCF is their guardian or their parent because they can't live at home because of abuse or neglect conditions. And so once they're housed in these facilities, I think it's important to understand that these are children with very profound unmet needs. And to the extent that the goal of the facility is public safety, it's really about treating those unmet needs.
So let's talk about what exactly is in this report. I guess first I'll ask, why did you decide to take this long investigation into the conditions at this facility? What led to the report in the first place?
So several things led to a burgeoning investigation. At first into CJTS, there was no Pueblo. When we first began to get complaints about conditions, certain conditions at CJTS, I began at the Child Advocate's Office in September of 2013. And quickly, I'd say within the first few months, I received a number of written emails about from what I would call whistleblowers, you know, folks who are employed by the state and who have knowledge of conditions at CJTS, asking us to take a look at certain issues. Some of the concerns were complaints about management, but some of the concerns were raising pretty significant issues, one around inadequate training, two around inadequate suicide prevention, a couple around prolonged isolation. But there was a theme throughout several of these conversations, and it was that there are a cohort of kids in these facilities who have significant treatment needs that go unmet, and that the folks working with these kids, i.e. the staff, need help to meet the needs of those children. So, you know, that sort of began our more intensive look. Our staff is very limited, and I think it's important for folks to know, you know, the charge of the OCA is to investigate and respond and inform regarding publicly funded systems for children. That mandate is very broad. Our staff is very small. So one of the hardest things about our job is prioritizing what we do. So we did begin at that point to spend more time in the facility. But events sort of escalated and spiraled to increase the intensity of our investigation. And there are a couple things that led to that. One is the, you know, one of the pace of complaints continued. And when the girls' program, which is called Pueblo, opened in the spring, I think to sort of much controversy and debate, the complaints started right away, sometimes from advocates or lawyers and eventually from some staff members within the facility, concerned about the safety of youth within. Concurrent to that, Jane Doe, a youth that many who listen to your program and read the news are aware of, a transgender youth who the state petitioned to send to the Department of Correction, was also placed at Pueblo during the summer of last year. And concurrent to that, there were a number of complaints made to our office. We began to request videotapes of incidents that were being brought to our attention. And it was videotapes that I had not reviewed any tapes from CJTS or Pueblo at that point. And the facilities are taped for quality assurance purposes. So I requested videotapes, and what I saw on those tapes, particularly from the girls' unit, I thought was shocking. Shocking, and depicted dangerous conditions for youth just over one weekend in July.
And when you say dangerous conditions, talk about what those conditions are, because we'll talk about the use of restraint and seclusion specifically, but maybe describe the conditions that you're talking about.
So just in that snapshot in time, we saw children being repeatedly restrained to the floor. We saw a girl who was repeatedly prone restrained, which means restrained face down, whose treatment file had a medical alert that she'd not be restrained that way because of a respiratory condition. We saw the use of handcuffs and shackles. We saw a girl in extreme crisis and distress being left in her room or cell, as you would call it, isolated with the door closed, who then would escalate into hurting herself. We saw depiction of blind spots in at least one girl's room, who was found during that weekend in the corner with a ligature tied around her neck so tightly that a rescue tool was needed to cut it off. I looked at these things. I felt that they were absolutely depicted a unit that had some crisis issues, but potentially depicted top-to-bottom concerns around support for staff, training, documentation. When kids – it took me almost no time, John, to find – I mean, over the next few weeks, to find at least a half a dozen other youth who were in prone restraint and who had medical alerts in their file. That told me not necessarily that that happened every single day in the facility, but the fact that that happens at all told me, and I communicated this to the department at the time, that they potentially had a top-to-bottom problem in the facility, that everything from operations to training to documentation to use of harmful and dangerous restraints, face-down restraints, are defined now in Connecticut law as dangerous.
So we're talking with Sarah Egan, who's the state child advocate, and her office put out a big report about the conditions at the CJTS, the Connecticut Juvenile Training School, and its Pueblo Unit for Girls. And it's a harrowing report that has both hard statistics and also some very scary stories about restraint and seclusion. We're going to be talking in just a couple of minutes about the state's response to this. So all of this sounds terrible. And so now the next question is, the things that you saw on these tapes and the things that you heard stories about, were these a result of people being trained badly to do something the right way? Was it the result of people breaking protocols or the result of poor protocols? I mean, how do you take a look at, not necessarily just to assign blame, but to say, here's what we see that's wrong. Clearly, the whole of it is terrible.
Right.
But how do you pick out what's wrong here versus what's wrong there?
So I think that's a really good question, because one of the things we focused on a lot were protocols and training. You know, this report, as I've said before, is not an indictment of individual staff members. One, without individual staff members calling our office and putting us on the alert, I would never have investigated the program. I wouldn't have known what to investigate. So throughout our investigation, we were able to talk to various individuals, both at the program and at DCF Central Office, about the types of things that we saw and reflect on that. But staff and other folks within the facility, they do what they're supported and trained to do. And research around the country from juvenile justice experts and criminal justice experts confirms that one of the largest predictors of positive outcomes for youth is training for staff that work with them. So one leading set of progressive standards in the country recommends 200 hours of training for new employees in these types of facilities over the first 2 years, 160 hours the first year and 40 the second. And the training has to be about, who are these kids? Who are their families? What type of work are we trying to do? How do we work with them given all the trauma that they've experienced? How do we work with kids with mental illness? How do we do conflict resolution? So is there training at CJTS in Pueblo? There is pre-service and in-service training, but much more minimal than that which is described by those national standards, much more minimal than some other jurisdictions who have been leading the way in terms of reform of juvenile incarceration, like Missouri. And we're not training enough in those types of things so that staff do what they're trained and incentivized and supported to do. So if we want staff to be able to engage with traumatized youth in a way that builds trust and promotes treatment, they have to be trained to do that.
Do we need some sort of state laws about minimum standards? I mean, do we need to change policy somehow holistically as opposed to just providing better training?
So, yes. So I think number one is we have to immediately do harm reduction at CJTS in Pueblo and address restraint, seclusion, suicide prevention, response, all of that. I put all of that in the category of harm reduction. And that can be done in these programs. I have no question. And I think that's a lot of what the emergency action plan put out by the department earlier this week is about. And that needs to take place with a framework for expertise, importing it where necessary, transparency and accountability over progress and results. These are multi-million dollar publicly funded facilities that essentially belong to the public and serve the public's children. So that framework for inside-outside review has to be there as we measure progress towards harm reduction. But the other issue your question raises is, it's one thing to do harm reduction. It's another to say, do CJTS in Pueblo continue to be the future for juvenile justice response in Connecticut?
And that really gets to, I mean, that gets to the major point here, is harm reduction at a facility which for years now has been said to not be the place to really house these children who are in the greatest need. I mean, look, I think you were there when I did an interview with Nell Bernstein about a book called Burning Down the House, which talks about juvenile prisons around America. And she talks about these conditions over and over again and situations just like these. But the underlying point of the book is not these individual conditions. The underlying point of the book is that we're the only country in the world that actually sends kids to prison in this way. And so how do we get to that point? Because some mitigation of current problems is one thing, but it seems like we're spending millions of dollars to actually prop up a facility that was built during an administration that built a lot of facilities that maybe the state doesn't need, and now we're still putting kids there, and kids still aren't having good outcomes. I mean, do we need to have a bigger conversation, Sarah?
Yes, we absolutely have to have a bigger conversation, John, and I think that the time is ripe for that. You know, Connecticut, it's important to note, and the report does, is a leader in criminal justice reform. It's a leader with its Second Chance Society. It's been a leader in not incarcerating as many juveniles as some other states do. And somehow CJTS and Pueblo sort of stand in stark contrast to that. And I think the table is set really with all stakeholders, from the executive branch, the legislature, to other stakeholders in the community, families, to say, is this what we want to keep doing? Because, as you point out, this facility was outdated when it opened a decade and a half ago. It opened to much controversy. People didn't want it. It was an outdated model at the time. Nobody was building new juvenile prisons. And now, in the last 15 years, we've seen just a legion of research around the country from major organizations, Pew Charitable Trust, the Annie E. Casey Foundation, the Department of Justice, all talking about not only the expense, but the futility and the harms of juvenile incarceration for youth. And I think the time is now to we have to have that conversation.
So then the most important question then is, what is better? What helps? I mean, when I've sat down, and I probably will again soon, with the commissioner of the Department of Children and Families, she and her predecessors have talked about the fact that for a very small handful, and we are talking about a very small overall number of children who have difficult behavioral issues and no place else to go, sometimes they can be violent toward staff and toward other children. Sometimes they are very hard to control. So what do you do? Where do these kids best go so that they have the best outcomes? But indeed, we do have safety for everyone else concerned.
Right. So the good thing in this field is that there are a lot of answers to those questions. There are states, and we mentioned this in the report, that one state that a lot of stakeholders in Connecticut have looked to is Missouri. They have a model called the Missouri Model. They got rid of sort of large-style training schools and replaced them with small, therapeutic, regional programs that have been shown to be much more effective. Missouri has some of the lower costs per child for taxpayers, and two, one of the lowest recidivism rates in the country, if not the lowest. So they're both providing therapeutic treatment in the community and improving public safety, which is really what the public is interested in. The Pew Charitable Trust recently found that the public isn't interested in maintaining training schools. They're interested in public safety. So we know small works. We know trauma-informed works. And there's no question that there are some youth, probably a pretty small number, that may need secure treatment. But right now, as the department has acknowledged it's working on, we put kids into the training school in Pueblo without validated risk assessment tools. So there are kids there right now who really have mental health impairments. Most kids are there for nonviolent offenses. Many are there committed to the state on misdemeanor offenses. So does that mean there are no kids that may pose a risk and need treatment in a secure setting? No. But it's how is that delivered and how is that developed? And I think it can't be overstated that in this facility requires over $30 million a year to run, which is money that is being siphoned away from other more effective solutions. Number two is that the only purpose of the facility is public safety. And it's the most important indicator that the facility does not report on. So the taxpayers have been paying for an intervention that nobody has evaluated or reported on the efficacy of. And that is sort of the ball game. And then within that, you know, what training schools have been found to do around the country and including here on multiple occasions, this must be the fourth report, is that trying to treat kids' complex behavioral health issues in a juvenile prison, it just creates an environment that's ripe for problems and gives rise to the types of harms and risks, the very profound harms and risks that we see emerging here.
We just have a moment left, but I'd like you to respond. You mentioned it earlier. The state has responded since your report came out last week. The Department of Children and Families has said that they want to address the issues of restraint and seclusion that you enumerate in your report, that they want to deal with some of the staffing issues that you talk about in your report being the root cause of this. What's your response to how the state has responded to you?
So one, I think it's absolutely fabulous that something was put together so quickly that addresses so many different issues in the report. So that's number one. Number two, I thought it acknowledged a lot of the issues that we raised, which is also really important for moving forward. I think other issues that remain are, I do think that they're going to continue to need outside expertise to inform any changes. There needs to be a framework for transparency, accountability, and oversight of these changes in a publicly funded program. And then lastly, and I think this is for policymakers and public stakeholders to do, there has to be a strategic plan to address the larger question of whether we want to continue to infuse resources into an outdated juvenile prison model.
Sarah Egan is Connecticut's child advocate. We'll have more information about her report on our website, wnpr.org/where we live. Sarah, I really appreciate it. Thank you so much for coming in. When we come back, we're going to talk to a Yale law professor who's on President Obama's task force about policing. That's coming up next, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Michael Brown, Eric Garner, Tamir Rice, Walter Scott, Freddie Gray, Sandra Bland. Each name represents an African-American who died within the last year after a confrontation with police. One of these deaths was after a struggle caught on camera. One was not caught on camera at all, still leaving questions. One was a young man who was playing with a toy gun. One was an older man who ran after a traffic stop. One was a younger man who ran after making eye contact with a police officer. And one was a woman who was found dead in a cell only days after another traffic stop for the minor offense of not using a signal to change lanes.
You okay?
I'm waiting on you. This is your job. I'm waiting on you. What do you want me to do?
You seem very irritated.
I am. I really am. I feel like it's tough with what I'm getting a ticket for. I was getting out of your way. You were speeding up, tailing me. So I move over, and you stop me. So, yeah, I am a little irritated, but that doesn't stop you from giving me a ticket. So.
Thank you, sir.
Come out. Are you done?
You asked me what's wrong, and I told you.
Okay.
So now I'm done, yeah.
Okay. Do you mind putting out your cigarette, please, if you mind?
I'm in my car, but I have to put out my cigarette.
Well, you can step on out now.
I don't have to step out of my car.
Step out of the car.
That's a recording from the arrest of Sandra Bland. Each of these deaths represents a different kind of story about interactions between Black Americans and police officers. They're the kinds of confrontations that Tracy Mears is trying to stop. Mears is a professor at Yale Law School and a member of President Obama's Task Force on 21st Century Policing. She joins us from the studios of Yale University in New Haven today. Tracy Mears, welcome to Where We Live.
Good morning.
First of all, I want to start with the Sandra Bland story. And I'm wondering specifically, as someone who has studied policing so closely over your career, what you take from that incident. What are the things that strike out to you immediately as something to note for us all?
I think three things. The first thing that I thought was very notable about the incident was the way it started, which was, relatively cordial. Let's leave aside for a moment the reason why he pulled her over. But if you're looking at the incident at the beginning, he did many things correctly. You know, he was cordial. He explained why he stopped her, so on and so forth. So that's the first thing to note. I think the second thing to note is the interaction at the point at which it seemed to take a wrong turn. And that's when he asked her if she would put out her cigarette. And she said no. My read on that is that it's what we might call a classic case of contempt of cop. He was not happy that she did not immediately comply with what he asked her to do. And he responded by telling her to get out of the car and kept calling that a lawful order, an assessment with which she disagreed. We can talk about that, too. My own view is that I don't think it was appropriate and probably unlawful, but there's an argument that it could have been called such. And the third thing is, going back to the beginning of the incident, is the reason why he pulled her over. It's an interesting question, I think, that people should ask themselves how many Anglo-Americans compared to African-Americans are pulled over for failing to signal on a lane switch. There's some really great new research out by Charles Epp and his colleagues, a book that was published by the University of Chicago Press in 2014 called Pulled Over, How Police Stops Define Race and Citizenship. And what Epp and his colleagues show is that there are basically two different kinds of stops. One they call traffic stops. These are stops where police will engage a motorist for speeding or reckless driving, the kind of thing that I think people expect to be stopped for. And according to their research, both blacks and whites rate the friendliness and appropriate behavior of police officers, this is in Kansas City, about the same way in these traffic stops. But there's a second kind of stop that they call investigatory stop. And in Kansas City, those investigatory stops are you know, minor low-level violations, such as turning too wide or driving too slowly. And what Epp and his colleagues found is that African-Americans in Kansas City were more likely than whites to experience an investigatory stop. And then second, when it came to traffic safety involvement, Kansas City police officers acted for the most part without regards to driver's race, right? So basically, there's some evidence showing that whites and blacks are treated differently, and this kind of stop that Sandra Bland experienced contributing probably to her irritation.
And that question of the reality borne out by those statistics you talk about and other studies leads to a perception amongst many African Americans that whether it's in their car or on the street, they are targeted by police more often for investigations, to be talked to just be asked a question than white Americans. If indeed the numbers bear this out, then I suppose Tracy Mears leads to the next piece of it, which is why African Americans largely may be distrustful of police officers. And I'm sure that plays into all of the incidents that I talked about and many more thousands of incidents as well.
I think it is. And one of the things that we paid attention to in the report, by we, I mean myself and the other 10 members of the President's Task Force on 21st Century Policing, we paid a lot of attention to the first pillar of our report, which is public trust and legitimacy in policing and procedural justice. And the procedural justice research, which has been in place for about 20 years, much of this work begun by my colleague Tom Tyler, also at Yale Law School, shows that people care a great deal about how they're treated by individuals in legal authority, such as police officers, but it also includes judges and prosecutors and the like. And they care more about how they're treated in some cases than the outcome of those encounters with folks in legal authority, such that, you know, you can just imagine the contrasting case, a situation where you get a ticket, but the person who's giving you the ticket is very polite and treats you respectfully and explains what he or she is doing. And the contrast scenario is a situation where you don't get a ticket, but you're treated very rudely and disrespectfully. And there's research that shows that people feel better about the former.
We're talking with Tracy Mears, who's a professor at Yale Law School and a member of President Obama's Task Force on 21st Century Policing. And if you want to join us, 860-275-7266. You can, of course, find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. I want to get back to that question in the Bland case of whether or not it was a lawful order to ask her to get out of the car. Something obviously a lot of Americans have been talking about is the question of de-escalating or escalating a situation. Obviously, we hear on tape there a motorist pulled over, she believes not rightly, who's irritated with a police officer. The police officer, as you say, is calm at first and then decides that he needs her to get out of the car. There's a lot of things to pull apart, but I think let's talk a little bit about the law of that, Tracy, because I don't think most Americans, black or white, would know if a police officer says, I want you to get out of the car. I mean, should you? Do they have the right? Under what conditions?
I think in most states, if there is reasonable suspicion for a traffic stop, and in this case, it was a violation of traffic law, failure to signal on a lane change. In most states, police officers are entitled to ask you to get out of the car once there is a legal stop. There's a question, though, about at what point that traffic stop has ended, you know, whether there is still reasonable suspicion for this stop. How long does it last? And in this particular case, I think what makes it murky is that he clearly made a decision. I think it's undeniable that he made the decision to ask her to get out of the car once she refused to put out her cigarette, and certainly asking her to put out her cigarette, he had no legal basis for. It's her car. It's her cigarette. I'm fairly sure I shouldn't say this with 100% confidence, but it's Texas. I'm pretty sure one can smoke a cigarette in one's car outside. And I think that's what makes it a little bit problematic and actually fueled the situation. She was already irritated. He made clear that he didn't really care about her response to his question. He was asking her if she was irritated, and she explained that she was. And then he said, "Are you finished?" That was a clear indication of disregard. And I think, you know, by any objective measure, he escalated a situation that didn't need to be escalated.
How, in your experience, and obviously this is going to vary widely amongst jurisdictions and police officers, but how are police trained to push back on maybe their own internal ideas about contempt of cop? I mean, and nobody likes to be told no. And in a position of authority, many police officers feel as though they have a very difficult, very dangerous job, and they want to have people comply with them. So what do you know about the training that police officers in America have about someone who, whether it's yells at them or just says no, doesn't want to go along with what they're asking, how they're supposed to respond versus how we sometimes see them respond?
John, the answer to that question is really, really difficult. And the first thing to understand about answering that question is to note that there are literally thousands upon thousands of policing agencies across the country, right? So depending on how you're counting them, something like 17 to 18,000 policing and sheriff's agencies. And it's not that each one of these thousands of agencies has a different training regime. But there are, in the thousands of training programs, there are state standards that differ across the country. Some states require, for rookies, you know, the initial training to be a rookie police officer. Some states actually require fewer hours of training to be a police officer than is typically required to be a barber. It's really difficult to answer the question with that kind of specificity. One thing I can say is that too many agencies do not train in these ideas that I was just speaking about, these ideas about theories of procedural justice that the public really cares about. And let me just review what the four points are, because I think that will be helpful to the conversation. When people assess how police treat them, whether they're being treated fairly, I call it rightfully in my own work, the public tends to focus on four factors. First, as I said before, whether the person in legal authority, let's just focus on police officers, is treating them with dignity and respect. Second, people look for indications that decisions are fair, made with reference to facts, not a function of bias or animus. And so you can see that factor playing out in the Sandra Bland incident. Third, people look for and value an opportunity to tell their side of the story. So again, in this particular incident, you know, the police officer asked her what she was doing, where she was going. People really appreciate an opportunity to have that kind of interaction. And fourth, people are looking for indicia that the police officer is going to treat them benevolently in the future. They're looking for ways to trust the motives of the police officer. And again, in the Sandra Bland incident, we see all kinds of indications that she didn't trust his motives. The point is those kinds of things, as opposed to outcomes or whether police are effective crime fighters, are the things that the public really, really cares about. And one of the things that we found in doing the public hearings for the president's task force is that too few policing agencies are training police officers in these ideas. Some are, but not as many as we need to have being trained in this way.
I want to get to one quick phone call before our break. Deborah is calling from New Haven. Hi, Deborah. Go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Hi. I have watched that video of the police following her and then pulling her over, and it reminded me of being stopped when I lived in Handen a number of years ago. I was on my way to work at one of the local universities in New Haven, and I was driving along as well, and I used to do this all the time. Mostly, I would see mostly African Americans being stopped or pulled over, usually close to the border and sometimes under the overpass. And the day that I was on my way to work, like I said, at one of the local U's going into New Haven, I saw a policeman following me, but I didn't nothing was going on. And then all of a sudden the siren went on. I wasn't driving too fast or anything. So I pulled over, I turned the corner and pulled over. I was irritated because I knew I hadn't done anything. I'm an older black woman, and so when he came up to see my driver's license, I immediately asked, could you tell me what I did? Because I didn't know what to think. And I think he said that I hadn't turned the signal, or it was some random thing that made absolutely no sense because I knew I had. And I had the strange feeling that I was probably targeted. When I asked the policeman what I had done, and he gave me the information, I showed him my license. When he saw that I lived in Handen, he said, I'm going to let you off with a warning, which incensed me because I didn't think that's what he had intended to do. He was polite, I will say that, but the stop to me was unfounded. I did tell my supervisor when I went to work, who knew a lot of policemen, and I have never been stopped again, but I will tell you, it is disturbing to see that. And this has been going on for years. That's all I have to say. When I watched that video, I had that same eerie feeling. She had an out-of-state license, which also made her a target. That's my feeling.
Deborah, thank you very much for the phone call, and I appreciate it. And I think, Tracy Mears, maybe just a reaction to Deborah's story. That is the story, essentially, that is borne out in statistics from many studies around America, that the traffic stops like this can very well be commonplace, especially at town borders, especially with African Americans. And even that little coda that said incensed her was that once the officer found out that she was actually from the town where he was from, it's no big deal anymore.
I think that's right. I have my own story. In my case, I was driving a Volvo. It was my 30th birthday, and a cop pulled me over for crossing a solid line rather than a dotted line. And this was in Chicago. And when he pulled me over, he appeared at my window and said, "Sir, may I have your license and registration?" It was winter. I had a big park on. And when I turned to look at him, he was obviously flustered, as I was not the young man that he thought I was, probably stealing my car that I was driving. And, you know, again, it's a classic case of an investigatory stop. I do want to emphasize that there are these two factors, I think, that really loom large in these investigatory stops. First, whether the person is treated with dignity and respect really matters a lot. But even when a police officer is polite and cordial to a motorist, and we've seen in many cases they're not. I mean, if you look at the analysis of stops and pedestrian stops in New York City, a very common complaint is that police officers are rude to New York City citizens. A second factor that really matters is the extent to which the person being stopped can ascertain whether there's a really good reason, in their view, for the stop.
We're talking today with Tracy Mears, who's a professor at Yale Law School, and she's a member of President Obama's Task Force on 21st Century Policing. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation and take some of your phone calls at 860-275-7266 here on Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up tomorrow, it's The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. We'll be taking a look at some national politics, including getting ready for the first presidential debate of the 2016 campaign. I know that you're very excited about this. We're also going to be talking about the circus atmosphere at this week's meeting of Hartford Democrats as they were nominating a candidate for mayor. We'll be talking about that and much more coming up tomorrow on The Wheelhouse here on Where We Live. Hope you can join us. Today on the program, we're talking with Tracy Mears, who is a professor at Yale Law School. She's also on a task force put together by President Obama to take a look at 21st century policing. And we're taking some of your phone calls at 860-275-7266. A quick call from Ellen, who's in her car, I believe. Hi, Ellen. Go ahead.
Hey, John. Good morning.
Good morning.
I just wanted to tell you quickly that we're working directly with the New Haven Police Department. I'm working with a nonprofit called Live Kind, and we're working with their summer camp kids and creating videos with kids talking about their fears with regard to police. And we're talking with police officers with regard to what they're looking at when they walk down the street, what they want kids to know about working effectively with police, and trying to start with kids at a much younger age to build trust because it clearly isn't there.
Ellen, thank you very much for sharing that, and I it helps me get to actually to something, Tracy, I want to ask you about, because I know that you've been working with the police force in the city of New Haven since you arrived at Yale University, and looking at some of the things we've already talked about around policing and other issues as well. I mean, I guess I'm wondering if on the ground you've seen some changes in the city of New Haven where Yale is.
Well, one of the things I've seen is a greater commitment to the idea of pursuing community policing. And we've had a few changes in leadership in New Haven over the last several years. And I think Dean Esserman, the current police chief, is certainly committed not only to the principles of community policing, but also these ideas of procedural justice. And I have participated in training its command staff, and I know there are some plans for incorporating more of this training for the rank and file. These processes can take some time because police forces are large, and you can only take a certain number of folks off the street at any given time. But I know that there's definitely a commitment to these ideas in this city.
We're going to be talking actually on Friday's program here on Where We Live about a spike in violence in the city of Hartford. The number of murders this year has gone up to 19 already, only about halfway through the year, which is higher than it's been in recent years. And one of the conversations, Professor, is about whether or not more police on the streets would actually help. This is something that has happened summer after summer since I've been covering the city of Hartford, which is violence spikes in the summertime. We put more cops in the streets, maybe state police, and that is meant to quell violence, but it's a cycle that seems to repeat itself. What can you tell us about the numbers of cops in a city like, say, New Haven or Hartford, and how that actually aligns with better outcomes, not just violent crime like murders, but just better outcomes overall for the citizenry?
Right. For a long time, it was very difficult to tie increases in the numbers of policing to changes in the levels of crime. It is certainly the clarion call of police executives, usually, this belief that more police automatically translates into lower crime rates. I don't think that the data analysis is that straightforward. What is clear is that certain policing techniques are associated with lower crime levels, being very focused in terms of where police officers are deployed, and also being very focused in the approaches that police officers take in dealing with people who are prone to engaging in violent crime. So I've been involved both in Connecticut and in Illinois, in Chicago in particular, and in New York, with particular violence reduction strategies where you communicate to people who are those who are most likely to have guns about the consequences of having guns. It's done in a respectful way, consistent with procedural justice ideas, combined with information about the availability of services. And when those strategies are done in the right way, in New York and Chicago, the data here is a little less clear because the program's at the at its outset, but we expect to see good results here in Connecticut too. It's associated with drastic levels of reductions in crime. So, you know, I think to sum up, it's not so straightforward, and I'm sure I might get some hate mail at this point, that increases in police are is necessarily the best way to reduce violent crime. But being very smart about how you use police is definitely a way to go. Now, that said, maybe Hartford doesn't have the minimum level of forces that it needs. I don't know.
Mm. We just have a couple minutes left, and I started our conversation asking you specifically about some of the things you may draw from the Sandra Bland case. I also started to our conversation reading a list of names that obviously have become all too familiar to us: Michael Brown, Eric Garner, Tamir Rice, Walter Scott, Freddie Gray, Sandra Bland. But there are so many more. If you look at all these cases, and there are so many different fact patterns in there, as part of this task force that you are on with President Obama, do you have a through line there? Is there one thing or one or two things that you and your colleagues have been looking at that say, yes, this is part of the problem, this is part of the thing we need to solve as we see these incidents all across America?
The central factor that we paid attention to, John, is what I mentioned at the outset, which is that it is absolutely necessary to increase the level of trust between police and the communities that they serve. You know, one way of thinking about this is to say this, and it actually goes back to what we were just talking about. Treating people fairly is a public safety approach. It's a crime fighting approach. If police are seriously interested in reducing crime, they must be committed to treating people fairly. We know from decades of research that being committed to these ideas of procedural justice not only encourages people to voluntarily comply with the law, it makes them more likely to cooperate with police, which makes crimes easier to solve. It helps people to engage with folks in legal authority. It makes them more committed to the places that they live. They shop more. They are more likely to vote. In short, this is one of the major important stepping stones to building a real citizenry, actually, in the places in which we live. So I think this idea of public trust is really the golden thread here.
And of course, the very important difference now and in the past was that if say, you grew up in Baltimore and the Baltimore police had a certain relationship with you, that was the only relationship with police you may have. But now we see videos from around the world, actually from around the country, that show police interacting with people. And it's almost as though every place, Tracy, is our neighborhood, right? Every interaction that we see in Texas or in Cleveland or in California is actually an interaction that we could be having here.
I think that's right. And it also makes very clear the dichotomy between the way some groups are treated. So for many white Americans, I think they haven't really questioned very much whether or not they could trust the police, and maybe thought or used to believe that the incidents that we now see every week, every other week, were extremely rare. And while it is true that, you know, the level of police violence against people in general and against African Americans as a group has gone down over, you know, the decades since, let's say, the 1950s, it is a situation in which it seems to be much too common.
Tracy Mears is a professor at Yale Law School. She's a member of President Obama's Task Force on 21st Century Policing. She joined us today from the studios of Yale University in New Haven. Professor, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
I want to thank our production team, Lydia Brown, Tucker Ives, Betsy Kaplan, Kyle Wolf, Heather Brand, and Katie Talarski. Thanks to Jules Lefebvre today. I'm John Dankosky. This is Where We Live.